This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. We're continuing in the program today with our conversations with members of the Northwest Indiana Legislative Delegation. And we have with us to begin our programs today with State Representative Earl Harris, Jr. of East Chicago. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
Well, first, a little just brief background here. Mr. Harris, of course, is a member of the House of Representatives, was elected to the seat in the House of Representatives in 2016 in House District Number 2, which is in Lake County. And a number of the projects that you focused on, I know, deal with your interest in education.
Correct.
Tell us a little bit about yourself for some people that may not know much about you.
Sure. Live in East Chicago, born and raised there, as you mentioned. My background has to do with media and with education. I worked in public education for a long time. I ran a television production department for a school system. And then I also do television video production. I have a company called Motivation Media, and I do television video production. Anything from I've done broadcast television. If I can brag for 2 seconds, I have a Emmy nominations for a show I used to do on Fox Sports Midwest. I do corporate marketing, et cetera. So I'm a big media guy and love creativity.
I know that many of your projects have had to do with Northwest Indiana media as well, too. And some of the topics that you bring up in your bills that you've sponsored or you've had co-sponsored in this past legislative session deal in particular with educational issues. One in particular that you have is House Bill 1419. It's gone on to at least review in committee, and it's dealing with some of the problems that we face here in Northwest Indiana with the lead issues, and certainly I'm sure in East Chicago, but in other school districts, of course, Hammond is another one that
Correct.
They've had some problems with issues involving lead pipes and not only faucets, I guess, that are in the fountains in schools, but also, too, I guess, just the sinks. Tell us what got you going with that in particular on dealing with the problems of the lead problems in some of the school fixtures.
Well, as you mentioned, East Chicago, and as you know, it received not only local attention but national attention. My home city of East Chicago had a lead issue, which was a pretty big issue for the city. Mm-hmm. I was actually at a conference, a Great Lakes conference, last year. And one of the things that was discussed, and I forget which state, it was Ohio, Michigan, I forget which state, there was a representative that said that they had a school district that purchased for a new school water fixtures that they bought. They were all from China. And there was no testing done, so they got the best. This was the least expensive option. Well, it actually ended up costing them more because what happened was when they received the lead fixtures in, the faucets for the school, they were all lead lined. And so they ended up having to shut down all the water access for kids in the school, and they had to purchase, obviously, new fixtures, et cetera. So it actually cost them more. So the legislation has to do with testing that to make sure, testing any new water fixtures and faucets that come in to make sure that that issue does not happen, since obviously we've had enough lead issues in East Chicago and Northwest Indiana already.
Now, the bill, I guess, went on to go to at least to a review and committee. Did it make any further, I guess, or just introduction and went to the committee?
No, it didn't. And Senator Randolph and I both filed legislation, just to give him credit as well. And unfortunately, neither of our pieces went through the entire process and became law. But that doesn't mean that you give up. I mean, we understand the reality of the long game, as I like to call it. So if you don't get something done the first year, you continue to work on it. And this is too big of an issue when you talk about young people's health for us to walk away from it after 1 year.
One of the other measures that you brought up as well in session, and it was at least kind of as well in the education committee, was talking about, a resident tuition. Has that been a big problem to address in the school city of East Chicago in recent years?
Well, I really think it's something that has to do – it's actually aimed at college. So I think it's an issue that we need to work on. And really a lot of the background in that for me is we have a workforce development issue. So the more people we can get into education and training post-high school, the better. And we have a lot of people that are undocumented, that are in the process of working on becoming citizens, that want to continue their education. And we know that expense is a part of it. Whether you're born here or not, college is expensive. And so this is to allow those people that are currently undocumented but working on becoming citizens to be allowed to have in-state tuition, which will help us in the sense that there'll be more people that can get post-high school education and be ready for the workforce. Because, again, we know here in Indiana and even nationally, we have a huge workforce development issue. So the more people that can get an education after high school, the better it is. And this is something that, you know, I started when I came in. The business community has been behind it because they obviously see the issue that they're facing in terms of finding qualified people to bring in as employees. So, again, you know, the long game, we'll continue to work on that. And continue to build up support, and hopefully sooner than later we'll get that passed and it'll become law here in Indiana.
Another measure you introduced in this past legislative session was a House bill that takes up the issue of property tax deduction, certainly for seniors, in particular ages 65 yes. and older. It's another one that got, I guess, up for review on the House Ways and Means Committee. So at least it's gone on and didn't make it any further this session. But as you say, there are a lot of these measures have to be introduced if they haven't been before to mm-hmm. at least to be talked about. And tell Correct. Us more about that one.
This one actually came from – this idea came from a constituent in East Chicago. We had a conversation actually at July 4th, East Chicago's annual July 4th event. And, you know, when you get to a point where you've retired, your income obviously decreases. A lot of people have paid off their houses, but they still have to, you still have to pay taxes no matter what.
Right.
And there becomes a situation with some people where because their revenue, they're on a fixed income, they can't afford the taxes on their house. And you hate to see someone who's lived in the house for decades, paid it off, been a good provider, good citizen, to then have to give up their house because they can't pay the taxes. And so this is aimed at giving a tax break for those that are 65 and older. It's not for, you know, any size house. I mean, if you're, there's a financial limit where if your house is worth this much, it doesn't, you know, you probably have the expenses. You probably have the
right.
the income or the money to take care of it. But I hate the thought of, and I've had conversations with people, and Indiana AARP has been involved in this with me, hate the concept and the thought of people losing their house after decades of, you know, being good people and paying it off and then not being able to afford the taxes on it anymore.
One of the other measures that you introduced in during the session and has had gone through for discussion in this past session is gotten a lot of support. In fact, you got co-authors from State Representative Mary Candelaria Reardon in Munster and other members from the legislative delegation here as well. Talks about an issue that maybe people have talked about, and I know that the Food Bank of Northwest Indiana brings it up all the time, is dealing with student hunger.
Correct.
And homelessness kind of fits into that picture as well. What got you interested in that, and where does that stand, even though it didn't come up, I guess, for a vote in this session this time?
Last summer, Representative Candelaria Reardon and I were actually at the same conference. We were at NALEO, which is National Alliance of Latino Elected Officials, and sat through a session that had to do with college students that face issues with lack of food, lack of or homelessness issues. And this was one of those sessions where you sit through and then your mouth drops and your eyes get big, because I really did not know it was as big of a problem. We don't know the exact number yet, which is what my legislation is aimed at beginning process of this, but the thoughts that there are some 30 to 40% of our college students that face those issues. And it's not just an issue here in Indiana. It's also an issue nationwide. There's been a lot of attention probably over the last 6 months to a year that's been given about this. There's been stories on a lot of the network programming as well. And again, going back to my focus on education and workforce development, when you look at 30 to 40% of our young people facing those issues, there's a big percentage of those students that drop out of college, not because they can't hack it, but because of the financial part of being able to pay for food or being homeless. And we also live in Indiana, which means we have winter. We had minus degrees weather. And so, you know, if you're a student and you're sleeping in your car and you're eating maybe once a day and, you know, you're dealing with winter and you call mom and dad are probably going to tell you to come home because they don't want their baby sleeping in a car when it's minus 10, minus 20 degrees and it's snow and ice on the ground. So we're losing students that never get back into the education process. We're losing that brain power, again, not because they can't hack it, but because of the financial stress. You know, and we've had, you know, there's conversations you have and people go, oh, well, they get scholarships, they get this, they get that. Scholarship may pay for your classes, it may pay for your books, but it doesn't pay for you to eat three meals a day. It doesn't pay for where you're going to stay, et cetera. So, you know, it's important to me. This has become a big focus of mine, and I'll continue to fight for this, to make sure that we help young people get an education, make sure that they live a better life, and that they can become productive citizens, especially those that want to.
We're talking with State Representative Earl Harris, Jr. from East Chicago, and you're very much involved in these issues, in particular here with, I guess, the student hunger and the homeless issue. Mm-hmm. When you had a chance to talk with folks in your district, what have they told you the most that you've gotten, certainly what you've learned about, maybe that you weren't aware of, but in particular helped you craft the measure that you put in this last session?
You know, when I came back after the conference and really started having conversations with people before session, not mm-hmm. only locally, but even in Indianapolis, so many people's response was, yes, thank you. This is a problem. We just hadn't really tackled it yet. So there's a lot of interest in that locally here in Northwest Indiana, as well as Indianapolis. And there's a need, and the universities love the idea of having someone champion this because they know it's a big issue for them. A lot of them have put in different food bank and different supports, but they know that it's not enough, and they fight to keep students in when they face these financial issues.
One of the other measures that you introduced and brought up during this past legislative session is a topic that, of course, we talk about on the national level, which, of course, is the U.S. Census. But in particular, the measure that you proposed that's come up, at least in review, is trying to deal with the Indiana State Senate. The Senate had to, I guess, or the state census, I should say, had a count committee established. And what is the latest on that? I know that you've worked very hard on that. Is that still one of these, maybe one of these issues that may come up in a conference committee during the summer months?
Well, so I filed a piece of legislation on this. This is something that unfortunately, I don't know if the census count gets as much attention as it should because mm-hmm. of the importance of it. So what happened with it is the governor's office met with me, and they will be incorporating the plan and structure that I put into the legislation. They will be incorporating that into the state's plan for how they're going to deal with the census. I don't know if everyone knows the relevance of it in terms of the amount of funding you receive as a state, your congressional seats. I mean, states have gained and lost congressional seats based on their population. When you talk about money that comes in terms of funding from federal dollars, it's based on population. That helps in terms of education. That helps in terms of roads. We need to know how many people live in our state and in the different areas so we know what kind of services that can be provided. And I want to point out something that's important to know because we want to make sure that every person is counted. There's different ways that are going to be used to count people. I mean, you can go online and do this. You can call on the phone and do this, or you can actually call and have someone come out to your house. So if you're not really a technology person, they will come out. And then also the homeless population is counted. So there's a lot of effort put into that, as well as the undocumented population as well, because we want to make sure that all of the people that are living here in Indiana are counted. Because again, this has to do with the funding that comes in from the federal level, and also has to do with congressional districts for our state.
You're a member of the Indiana Black Legislative Caucus, along with many other members here in Northwest Indiana and yes. Indianapolis in particular. It seems they've hosted town hall meetings in the summer months. Are there any plans to have one coming up this coming summer?
Yeah, we actually start them this Saturday in Indianapolis. So we usually start them in Indianapolis. And we'll be headed all over the state. We'll be in South Bend. We'll be in Evansville. We'll be in Lafayette, Jeffersonville. We will be coming to Northwest Indiana, and I'm trying to be smooth here and look on my iPad, on my calendar, and delay as I try to find the date. But we will be coming to Hammond a little later in the summer. So we really make sure that we head out throughout the entire state so that we can talk to as many people as possible. And, you know, part of that also is to not only update people in terms of what happened in the legislature, but also get people motivated so that they get engaged in the process, whether it's to be future people that run for office or just get engaged in the process in other ways. And actually, I've been able to delay long enough. The one that will take place in Hammond will be on August 17th, which is a Saturday. We don't have a location locked in yet, mm-hmm. but those town halls all take place starting at noon. They usually last 2 hours.
When you take up these issues, and you get certainly a lot of constituent questions and the like, as most state representatives do, in particular, it seems, this is one topic I know that has come up before, and you brought it up here, the Black Legislative Caucus is going to, I'm sure, get a lot more topics. Do you find that these are questions when you have the town hall meetings, and like in this case coming up here in the region this during the summer, that these are projects that are topics, I guess, that turned into projects that they maybe
yes.
get turned into future bills, because you have a time here between now and the 2020 session to get some ideas together.
That's actually one of the purposes also of it, is to get ideas from the public in terms of things we should work on legislatively. Mm-hmm. So we always are very open, and I say this as a member of the Black Caucus, as well as a member of the General Assembly as a whole. We're always interested in ideas that come from our constituents, that come from the public, because you're living day to day. And so any help we can get in terms of ideas to make life better for people, we're always open to hearing those.
We have an opportunity here during our time on the program today to look in particular how the 2019 General Assembly session did in crafting the two-year state budget. This is a big budget writing session. What are your ideas, your take, we'll say, on what did come out that the lawmakers did pass this session?
Well, there were some good things that came out of the budget, and there were some not so good things. Again, my background with education, public education, you know, I really wish there was more that had been done in terms of teacher salaries. That was a big issue for us. You know, the way that the funding cycle goes in terms of which school districts receive money or more money. Really, urban and rural school districts are actually going to take more of a hit than other types of school districts. Again, there's no direct money that heads to teachers. You know, I know that there's been some talk of people saying, well, we're giving money to school districts and we want to keep it local so we're not mandating that it goes to salaries. Well, you can still make it local and mandate that it goes to salaries, and then give the local control to the school districts to decide, do you want to give raises a flat, say, 5% across the board, or do you want to base it on years of service? I mean, so school districts still will have local control, even if we mandate as a state that money goes to directly to teachers. And we also know, you know, when I talk about the workforce development and different things I'm working on, we know we have a huge teacher shortage, and we have people that live in Indiana that won't teach in Indiana. My best friend's niece, she was teacher of the year in her school district 2 years ago, and I've had many conversations with her, and she talks about her friends that are teachers in Indiana, since we're so close to the state line. They go to Illinois. The pay is better. The structure is better there. So we really need to do something to improve the situation for our teachers. Otherwise, you know, we're going to continue to have a shortage of people that get into education and teach in Indiana.
Do we find that we have the issue of course, of people in Illinois wanting to come live in Indiana, work in Indiana, particularly for the taxation benefits that they get, especially if they're looking to buy a home and want to pay less on property taxes? But then we have this issue with education. Is this a kind of a conundrum that we're trying to deal with these days, where residents from Illinois want to come live over here, but in turn we have residents in Indiana that will end up living in Illinois because they get better education for their students?
Well, you know, that's one of the things we've been working on, is really drawing people over from Illinois. I mean, when you talk about property taxes, you talk about the cost of groceries, you talk about gas. I mean, if you go to a grocery store or a gas station here in Northwest Indiana, you see a lot of Illinois plates because people come over because it costs less to buy gas and groceries here. What we want them to do is move over to the state. I'll tell you a quick story. I was at Mayor McDermott's Festival of the Lakes. This was 2 years ago. And I had met a young lady at the AT&T store getting services, you know, redone, set up, et cetera. And we got into a conversation while I was waiting for friends at the entrance of that. And she and her boyfriend came in, and I joked with her and I said, hold on a second, because she had told me, you know, they buy groceries, they shop, they do all these things. Now they're coming over to Indiana for their entertainment. I said, you basically sleep in Illinois. Just move over. And her boyfriend actually is from Munster, and he looked at me and he said, I've been trying to get her to do that for years. So, I think as we continue to do things like the trains, the South Shore, what we're doing there, there was actually money, going back to the budget, there was money put in for that will help in terms of getting the double tracking done in the West Corridor. As we continue to make moves like that, it'll continue to draw people over from Illinois that can live in Indiana, and even if they work downtown, they're a 25-minute ride away, which, you know, is pretty convenient considering, you know, paying a lot less money to live over on the Indiana side and still being able to work downtown Chicago.
Have you found that your interest in becoming a state legislator, of course, stems from the fact that your father, Earl Harris, was a longtime legislator, and then when he passed away, that your mother took over in his spot, kind of bringing that legacy on a bit? Are you feel like that you're picking up the legacy that your mom and your dad have started in becoming a legislative representative?
I am. I jokingly tell people it's the Harris family plan for world domination, and it's starting with the second House District State Rep. I mean, it's a great honor to follow in the footsteps of my parents. And I have to say, my father left such a great legacy behind that has benefited me in the work that I've been able to do, the, you know, relationships that I've been able to continue on that he had, as well as building new relationships. So, yeah, I mean, it has been a great benefit to me and help to what I've been able to do here in terms of Northwest Indiana and getting things done. And I greatly appreciate and give honor to what the year plus that my mother served and the 33 years that my father served. Mm-hmm.
We talked about some of the measures that you offered up in the 2019 session that have moved along. Are there any of these that you're carrying on, or are you going to plan to carry on into the 2020 session?
Yeah, the help for students that have food and homeless issues, that's too important to me not to let let go. So I'll continue to work on that. Anything to do with workforce development and education, I'll continue to work on because I believe so much in those. The property tax. So there's a lot that things that that didn't become law in this past session that I'll continue to work on and I'll bring back next session. I just think we have so much here in Northwest Indiana to offer, and there's so many assets and there's so much wonderfulness here. Anything we can do to make the lives of our citizens and constituents better, I'm focused on doing that and we'll work on that. And there's things that I've been working on, you know, now the session's over. It's kind of a switch in terms of what we do and how we do it. So there's a lot of education things going on in workforce development that I'll continue to focus on.
Well, Representative Harris, thank you for spending time with us to talk about some of these issues that you've introduced, at least have gotten a hearing in many of the committees. And as always, it takes maybe sessions in some cases to get these ideas up and running and sometimes to get them before lawmakers in Indianapolis. This gives you an idea that you don't give up. It's one way that you can help keep these going and, again, bring these back up in the next session. Thanks for taking these up with us today, and we hope that we do get to see them again, and particularly some of the ones that have brought up some of the issues of the homeless and the issues of how young people in Northwest Indiana have to deal with these every day, it seems.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for bringing this up, and we hope to have you back in to talk again here in the next session again.
I'd love to. Thank you.
State Representative Earl Harris Jr. is a Democrat. He's representative in Northwest Indiana in Lake County, and you're listening to Regionally Speaking here on Lakeshore Public Radio. We're continuing our conversations with members of Northwest Indiana's legislative delegation with State Representative Michael Aylesworth. He's a Republican from Hebron and represents residents in that area. They're in South Border and surrounding counties. And Michael, thanks for joining us on the program today.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Well, looking back at the 2019 General Assembly session, there are several bills. One in particular, I'm sure you're most proud of being involved with, which is one that the governor has signed, which involves the Porter County election process. For folks that are not aware of that, tell us about it and about the efforts that went through the General Assembly to get it passed.
Well, as most of you know, Porter County had a terrible election experience in 2018 in the general election. And there was a lack of coordinated oversight of the election process. And the legislation sponsored by Representative Soliday and co-sponsored by myself made an attempt to clean that up. But the governor signed it and goes into effect the 1st of July.
What does we have mentioned some of the specifics of the measure when it came out and was introduced here. And we, of course, all know the what's had happened in Porter County in 2018, what were some of the things that you were sure of in the measure as it went through the legislative process that might be different, maybe certainly for Porter County, but very similar to what other counties in Indiana go through when they set up for elections and their election board process?
Yes, for many years we had a board of voter registration that oversaw the election process, and that really wasn't correct. It didn't fit modern statutes. Most counties have an election board, and we converted that over to the election board process with the county clerk being the top member and then a member from each party, two appointments each. And hopefully that will oversee the election process in a very positive manner. Yeah.
What were some of your colleagues in the House thinking of when they debated this issue? First, when it came up in committee, and then finally, I'm sure it came up in some at least discussion on the House floor.
I was at the committee meeting when the bill was presented, and there was some good discussion. Most people in both parties, both representatives, understood the need for change because they saw what a debacle the election was in November of 2018. And so there was generally good consensus and some questions as to process, of course, but the consensus that we needed to come into conformity with the rest of the state in oversight of the election. And I think that was proved evident here in the primary that just occurred. Things went fairly smooth.
Yeah, it certainly has. They're very pleased with how the primary election went in the communities because it all had to go to the Porter County registration, I guess, or voter election process, yes. I guess, in Valparaiso. Everything had to center in there, and then all the results came out for there, to be sure, too. One of the other measures I know that you were very proud of, because it also got approved by the governor, was involving county park boards. Tell us a little bit about how that process got started, the incentive to create the bill, and how it went through the session.
Well, the incentive was that the Porter County Commissioners wanted some more oversight and input into the management of the park system and the park board. They wanted some appointments on the park board. And some of the appointments, a couple of them come from the circuit court judge. And in many counties, the circuit court judge enjoys the appointment process. In other counties, they do not. So we made it optional that they could give those appointments up and let the county commissioners make some appointments. Because in most situations, when there's a complaint with the park system, people don't know who to call. They end up calling their county commissioner, who's the chief executive, and as a mayor, they call the commissioner in their district.
Yeah.
And so it made good sense for that to happen. I used to be a county commissioner for a couple of terms, so I understand it very well.
Do you think that with this passage of this measure becoming law, that's going to make it a lot easier, not just for Porter County, but for other counties as well that may have some questions about how their makeup of their particular parks and recreation boards work?
Yes, it should smooth into a transitional process where counties want to do that and allow the county executive to make appointments and the circuit judge not make the appointments. And they have to be bipartisan, of course, and it should be citizens that are knowledgeable in recreation or park issues. So I think it's going to be a very positive process. Mm-hmm.
We're talking with the state representative, Michael Aylesworth. He's Republican in the Hebron area, about the measures that he supported or sponsored and have gone through the process this past legislative session. There are some measures that I know that you introduced or co-sponsored that didn't make it. Tell us about some of the ones that you're probably a little disappointed that didn't make it through this time. And is there a chance that maybe you'll reintroduce them next session?
Well, I got a very important bill that in concept that I'm going to reintroduce next session,
yeah.
And that is to attack the E. coli issue that pollutes our waterways in the state from failed or improperly installed septic systems. We've never done any comprehensive oversight in septic inspections, only in a couple of particular counties. And my bill will say that there's going to be required septic inspections by a trained inspector certified by the State Board of Health to come and inspect your septic system, both the tank and the septic field, as well as the well location to make sure it's got proper distance away before any property can be transferred at first point of sale.
Are you aware in your area there in Hebron and elsewhere there in South Porter County that there are a lot of properties that have both wells to get the drinking water and also septic tank systems?
Yes, all over rural South Porter County, that's very common. The older properties especially don't have a properly installed septic field to leach out the leach bed, to leach out the septic material properly. And oftentimes there's a pipe from the septic tank that goes directly into a river or stream. And we've got 7,000 miles of E. coli contaminated streams in Indiana, as well as many of our inland lakes. With unnecessarily high E. coli counts, and we need to start doing something about that.
Are there any others that you'd like to see either you sponsor next session or help co-sponsor?
I'm always sponsoring a bill to equalize truck speed and car speed on the interstates. I think it's sort of silly that we have the trucks go slower. We're one of only five states that restrict truck speeds different than cars. Mm-hmm. It would, when I traveled all over the United States to see my grandkids, especially down south, traffic flows much better when everybody can go the same speed.
That's interesting.
So I'd like to move that ahead.
That's great. Before I let you go, Representative Ellsworth, I'd like to get your take on how you think that the new two-year state budget is going to shape up. I know there's been a lot of controversy. Not everybody voted for it, and not everybody was very happy with some of the results. But do you think that in overall that's going to be able to help benefit the state for the next two-year budget cycle?
Yes, we work very hard to balance our budget, keep a structural balance, not have to borrow money. We pay our bills and vendors on time. I know some of the other party would like to spend more money than what the state has available, like other states surrounding us, and we don't believe in doing that. I believe that our state should operate just like your own household budget. Mm-hmm. Spend what it can, keep some in savings, and stay within budget. And that's what we did, and it was a very successful session.
Well, Representative Ellsworth, thanks for spending time with us to bring us up to date on your take on the how the 2019 General Assembly went, and hope to have you back on the program soon.
Anytime.
State,
thank you.
We're talking with State Representative Michael Ellsworth. He's a Republican, and he's in Hebron. Continuing with our conversations with members of Northwest Indiana's legislative delegation, State Senator Eddie Melton, a Democrat from Gary, was a very busy member this past session. He was dealing with issues that include the impacts on gaming here in Northwest Indiana, which of course mentions the Gary casino licenses, economic development issues in the city of Gary, and many other major issues. And he also speaks out as well, too, on the new state budget that was enacted and signed into law by the governor. Here's our conversation. Senator Melton, let's get your reaction to the decision of the governor signing off on the gaming omnibus bill, which is a bill I know that that you had a great deal of interest in, because a lot of what was coming out of it was going to have major impacts on the economic development of the city of Gary.
Yeah, that's correct. And as you may know, I am a co-sponsor of that piece of legislation.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm definitely pleased that this bill has been signed into law. I think it sets the tone for economic development and growth in the city of Gary and also in Northwest Indiana, not just from a gaming perspective, but also the opportunities when it comes to growing and developing within the footprint of Buffington Harbor, where the casinos currently sit. And we look to develop that as an intermodal hub or intermodal gateway to North America.
That was one of the more important things I know that you had mentioned early on when the bill was first introduced, before it started going through the review and debate process in the General Assembly. It was what kind of impacts that would happen as a result of that. I guess now it's up to the folks that own the casino itself and decide, I guess, what they want to do. Spectacle Entertainment owns it, and they can go ahead with their plans to make their decision on the site that they want to relocate the new casino in.
Yeah, that's correct. It's our hope that they move forward with the project, which I am very optimistic that that's going to take place. The opportunities of development along that 8094 corridor is just endless in regards to not just the investment in the facility of a brand new hotel or casino, but the jobs and development and the building and constructing these structures, but also the 400 additional jobs on top of the current 800 that Majestic currently has will be truly transformational for the city of Gary and the surrounding areas.
Do you have any idea from the spectacle entertainment people as to whether they're going to have to get with NDOT and some other agencies and working things out for the access that they will need for whatever site they happen to officially announce?
Well, I'm sure just like any private decision, when a private entity is looking to construct or develop, they're going to work with the appropriate state agencies to make sure that everything is done accurately and appropriately.
Right, right. One of the other measures I know, too, that you co-sponsored, in addition to this particular measure that in turn involves the Gary, not only the casino, but the economic development pictured Buffington Harbor, but some other economic development areas as well, too. Tell us about how those bills turned out and in turn, what's going to be the impact here in Northwest Indiana on that.
Well, you know, I think 2019 was a very good year in terms of Northwest Indiana, you know, locking in additional, locking in the state funding in terms of the double tracking of the South Shoreline. That's extremely critical and important. Also, and not to shift gears, but I do think it's extremely important to discuss education and teacher pay.
Right.
And which I feel that is critical when we talk about economic development, when we talk about workforce development. Right now, Indiana is lagging behind our neighboring states when we talk about the level of starting pay and pay for teachers overall. I think we're ranking towards the bottom when we look nationally in terms of what teachers are getting paid. So that's something that myself and the entire Senate Democratic Caucus have been fighting for this year. Of course, we did not get the language that we desired in terms of specifically allocating dollars, new dollars, to teacher pay. The bill that I proposed, Senate Bill 399, which was also structured in an amendment format to go into the budget, was declined. Mm-hmm. And I provided a very clear and direct step to increase a clear and direct plan to increase teacher pay across the entire state. And this would include not only teachers, but guidance counselors and social workers and all those frontline teachers that are working with our students.
You also, I know, worked in the subject of education on not only the financial side of it as well, but also, I guess, making sure that the tax credits and all that would be appropriate to be able to help families that would like to be able to get their youngsters into school.
Yes, of course, you know, Indiana, we have a very 529 plan where individuals are looking to invest in higher education. One of the things I'll be looking at in 2020 is how do we compare to our neighboring states, Illinois and Ohio and Michigan, when we look at the 529 plan and make those investments. Some states, they offer more tax credits to the individuals and to the parents. And I think that we should evaluate how well are we doing. Would this help increase and entice individuals to relocate to Indiana so we can grow our population and we can invite growing families as we look at building this state up in that regard? So I think we have a lot of work to do. Mm-hmm. I think when we look at the possibilities, we got a lot of great options, but we have to make a commitment to ensure that we provide not just corporations, but we have to ensure that we provide the individuals that's willing to make these type of investments the incentives that we can that's going to make it more appealing to stay in Indiana as an individual and a family, but also to relocate to Indiana. As we know, a lot of folks are leaving the Illinois area, particularly the Chicagoland area, and looking to Indiana as an option. You know, what can we do to build that up and make us a premier option for folks to relocate, I think, is something that we have to consider in every front, in every aspect.
Right. I know that you very particularly in the area of workforce development, you talked, referred to that a bit here. It's one of the measures that you helped work on to move more to that point, which is something that the governor, of course, had stressed strongly. And in turn, you and your colleagues at the General Assembly have been trying to do so, too. It goes along with, like you say, trying to make sure that you can attract residents from Illinois and even from Michigan and Ohio to come to Indiana to take advantage of jobs here. But they can't take the jobs here if we don't have the proper education to get them ready for them.
Yeah, workforce readiness is an extreme priority to myself and especially to our caucus, the Senate Democrats. I'm a little disappointed in the way the state is making this more of a bureaucracy, of allowing the dollars and resources to be redirected locally. I think we're adding too many agencies on the state level, too many commissions and boards that slow up the progress and process. I know that we have to engage our industries, and that's extremely important. And we have to make sure that our teachers and our schools receive the adequate resources as well to make sure they have the infrastructure or the capacity to produce the workforce that we need. So there's an alignment issue I know that we're still striving to get. But I don't think we're going to get there by continuously adding on different boards and commissions that will come up with some of not really new results. I think we have to figure out how do we streamline our workforce development strategies mm-hmm. by still being able to partner with businesses and corporations and being able to directly support our education institutions, not just K through 12, but also our higher ed as education institutions. As you know, in Northwest Indiana, we have some of the best universities and colleges with Ivy Tech, with the multiple state institutions, but also our private colleges. So we have to figure out, and particularly from a regional perspective, what is the high demand jobs? What does that forecast look like in terms of students that are coming out ready and prepared? And working to get that message and communication on the programs that are available, and also talk about what type of programs do we need to create
right.
or invest in to ensure that we give students the ability to go into welding, okay. the ability to go into construction or electrical engineering, whatever that may be. So we have a long ways to go to perfect this, and I think that making it more of a streamlined, specific, and strategic approach is the best way.
Right. Senator Melton, we know not everything that you wanted to get in made it through the General Assembly session, and probably many of your colleagues feel the same way, too. Are there any topics that you are hoping might come up for a summer study committee to be worked on, or that you may have to, in turn, reintroduce as measures in the next session?
Yes, there's a few things. One, we have to address our infant and maternal mortality rate. We have, particularly in Lake County, we have a high number of in the infant mortality and maternal mortality rate that we have to address. When we look at education from a broader fashion, directing more dollars, not just to teacher pay, but to ensure that school districts across the state are having the dollars and the funds that's to support them. You know, we know that since 2009, school districts have been hit dealing with the property tax caps and ensuring that, you know, what do we do to support them so every year or every other year we're not requiring them to go for a referendum, which could fail or be successful. And I'm happy that the schools in my district, such as River Forest, have been successful to get the referendum passed through the community. So these are the things that we're going to have to be very mindful of in the next session, making sure that we listen to our stakeholders, listen to educators, listen to parents, listen to residents. I can go on. We have mm-hmm. multiple other projects.
What would you highlight as a few of those that you'd like to see either in study committee or become up as future bills?
School safety is another one. Mm-hmm. Increasing the minimum wage. I know this has been a conversation for over probably nearly 20 years. Indiana has been at around $7.25 an hour. That's not a livable wage when we look at the cost of living over the years. So that's something that we have to address. We have to talk about. I know it's very difficult for many companies and organizations that may be in opposition to that. But when I sit down and talk to the families that live in my district and they're not making a livable wage, that's something that has to be addressed.
Right. Well, it sounds like that there are a number of things that are on the list. Certainly could come up, as you say, during a study session if they are able to get them that way this year or to be able to produce together for the 2020 General Assembly session. Let me give you, as I've given other members of our Northwest Indiana Legislative Delegation, a shot here. Put your 2 cents worth in on the two-year budget that's now in effect in Indiana that was enacted after the General Assembly reviewed it this session.
The Senate Democrats offered multiple amendments to this budget, and many of them were denied. I actually had two amendments that were accepted in the Senate second reading amendments for the state budget. And during negotiations between the supermajority on both sides, those amendments were taken out. I had an amendment that would allow property tax amnesty. There are millions of dollars across the state, hundreds of millions of dollars. And in Lake County, we have probably over $100 million in terms of delinquent fees and fines of individuals that own property taxes. And I wanted to waive that for a year and allow individuals to pay the principal. So this allows more property tax dollars to go back to our local communities, to go back to our schools, but also keep folks in their homes. It addresses blight. So that's just an example of how, you know, having a supermajority does not reflect the entire state of Indiana in terms of some of the policies that we feel that our constituents deserve. It's not an equitable way of governing, in my opinion, where we're not able to move forward without sharing the thoughts and opinions that our constituents share with us and having to fight to get a hearing, a bill heard in the committee. I think we've done a little bit better job in working collaboratively this past session on giving Democrats hearings for their bills. But we have to move past that so we can start having debate and discussion so these things can be vetted. Because I'm elected just like my colleagues on the other side of the aisle are elected.
Right.
And the constituents that elect me are demanding and requiring that the policies that I'm putting forth have some type of recommendations. But that's not going to happen if we have a supermajority that locks out the opportunities to have these bills heard for discussion and debate.
Well, it sounds like that's an issue that's obviously going to have to come up at the ballot box again in the next election ahead when more representatives and senators are up for re-election or they leave the chamber and their successors have to take over. So we know that's going to be in the election process eventually to be able to make changes if they happen to the supermajority. And Senator Milton, we thank you very much for spending time to hear your two cents worth about this as well and the other issues, in particular the ones that have the most impact economically and otherwise here in Northwest Indiana. Thank you for spending time with us today.
Well, thank you. Thank you to your listening audience. And I encourage you all to reach out if you have any policy recommendations. And anyone listening that's in the Gary area, May 25th at 1 o'clock, I'm having my town hall at the Gary Public Library. And I'll be rolling out the additional dates for the rest of my district for Holbrook, Maryville, Crown Point, and Lake Station in New Chicago coming soon.
Well, that's great. We'll look forward to that information and look forward to the town meetings coming up. And you know that after this very interesting General Assembly session, you're going to get a number of people coming over to the library branch in Gary to listen to you and to have their comments made known as well, too. Thanks for being with us. That's State Senator Eddie Melton here in Northwest Indiana. With another edition of Eye on the Arts, here's John Kane with South Shore Arts.
Joining me for this edition of Eye on the Arts is Amy Davis Nevardauskas, who is now the executive director of the Art Barn School of Art in Valparaiso.
Yes, I am.
On one of those funny streets they have in Porter County with all numbers.
Yeah, county. It's on a county road.
What's the address? I think it's funny.
695 North 400 East.
Oh, I know exactly where you mean. Anyway, so you just started working there when?
Back in November.
Okay. So it's been 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
Good 6 months.
Like, I think a little bit more, but right around that spot. So,
Amy was the marketing director at the Lebesnik Center for the Arts in Michigan City for a long time. You're an artist yourself.
I am.
Yeah. And so now you're running the show.
Yeah.
And the Art Barn is a truly iconic place.
It is. We have of just about a 40-year history.
Yeah.
And our founder, Jan Sullivan, ran it for a number of years before her passing.
Yeah. So. She started it, didn't she?
Yeah, she did.
Yeah. Yeah. She was quite a character.
I don't think I ever met her, but that's what I hear. They called it Happy Jan's Farm.
Oh, really?
It was sort of the second name for the Art Barn.
She was great. I interviewed her here at Lakeshore a number of times, and
wonderful.
It was always eventful. It was like trying to interview the Golden Girls all in one, all four of them at once.
I can imagine that.
Yeah. So you have a juried exhibit coming up.
We do.
Tell us about that.
All right. So, well, we're in our 26th year of this exhibition that Jan Sullivan started. And so we're proud to carry on her tradition.
Mm-hmm.
We have all of our applications are in, and actually the show's on the wall ready for viewing. Mm-hmm. So there are... We had 202 pieces submitted, and we had to kind of narrow it down to about 90. But it's a really nice showcase of work from artists in the Northwest Indiana area, mm-hmm. and Northwestern Illinois.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and being a juried exhibit, you have a juror every year, and. Yes. Who is your juror this year?
Our juror this year is Alan Larkin, and he is from South Bend, Indiana. He had a 40-year career at IU South Bend as an instructor. So,
is he retired now?
I believe so.
Mm, cool.
Yeah,
he's quite an artist in his own right.
He is. He is wonderful. So we were really pleased to have an artist of his caliber to come in and jury our show, and he was great to work with. And you know, maybe one day he'll do it again. But we change our jurors every year.
Sure.
But yeah, he was great to work with this year. So.
And how many awards do you give?
We give, you know what, I haven't counted them all up, but I know we have about $5,000 to award in both purchase awards and merit awards.
And the purchase awards are so that you have a permanent collection?
Well, the purchase awards are not going to our collection. It's where people kind of front them. They kind of front the purchase,
uh-huh.
and then they select something from the show. So
these are for private collections?
Yes,
oh,
correct.
That's interesting.
And
yeah.
then we offer cash awards for merit.
How do you go about raising the money?
We have we just mostly ask individuals. I think it's all individuals this year. So it's amazing.
Do you have people who have given awards year after year?
We do.
Yeah.
We do. There are a few. I know Bill Wilson, who's actually going to be hosting our event, our opening reception.
Mm-hmm.
He usually makes a gift, and there are a few repeat. Our board is actually pretty generous as well.
Good.
So
when is your have you had your opening reception already?
No, the opening reception is going to be on May 18th.
Oh, great.
And
okay.
And it's up through the 27th of June.
Oh, that's good. So lots of time to go see the exhibit out there on that road.
Yeah.
I know exactly
where. It's only a mile south off of 6, so it's not hard to find.
So Art Barn also offers classes on an ongoing basis.
We do. We do all year round, and we're actually launching our spring summer session, it's launching now, so we're filling classes now.
Mm-hmm.
We've got all kinds of different offerings, so visit our website to see all those different offerings.
And you have you're doing some renovating, I understand.
We did. We got a grant from Porter County Community Foundation, so they helped us create an ADA accessible bathroom,
mm-hmm.
and we've got a nice fresh coat of paint, new fixtures. The bathrooms were bad, so they look great now. The lobby looks great, and we have a new pottery studio, so we're in great shape. Yeah.
Is pottery a really popular class for you?
It has. We just started it. So,
I see.
Classes are filling. So.
Yeah, we do really well with pottery in Munster, I find.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, good, Amy. That's great, and it sounds like you're off to a great start.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's been a lot of fun. It's a great place.
Good. Good. Well, thanks for being here to bring us up to date on your career and what's going on at the Art Barn.
Great.
And thank you for listening. We'll be back again next week with another edition of Eye on the Arts.
You can hear this conversation and previous conversations of Eye on the Arts on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org, and tune in again next Monday for another Eye on the Arts conversation here on Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks for joining us, and we'll be back with you tomorrow.